A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations. Today, we'll get some fresh insight into the life and music of Hildegard von Bingen, a 12th century abbess who blazed new paths not only as a female composer, but also as a scientist and religious reformer. Princeton University's Programs in Theater and Music Theater will hold a student reading of a new musical that tells Hildegard's story and features arrangements and remixes of her music in modern pop styles. I'll speak with director Elizabeth Swanson and some of the others behind the musical about the work and the woman behind it. As always, let's start off today's program with a look at some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. With 1 week to go before the start of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's season, it is still uncertain whether the musicians will return to the stage. The musicians were locked out in June when the orchestra canceled its summer programs. According to the Baltimore Sun, while the orchestra has said it plans to start its 2019-2020 season as scheduled, ending its lockout this Monday, the musicians have said they will not return until they have a new contract. A new round of negotiations were scheduled for Friday, September 6th, but as of Saturday afternoon, no word was available on whether the sides made any progress in resolving the conflicts between musicians and management, which is seeking to cut the orchestra season to 40 weeks from a current year-round schedule of events and make changes to wages and benefits to stem further losses. In response, Symphony President and CEO Peter Kiomi told The Sun that the orchestra would have to start canceling concerts if musicians did not return and that it did not have plans to hire replacement musicians. A season preview is scheduled for the evening of Saturday, September 14th. The musicians are planning on playing in a free concert that afternoon, conducted by music director Maren Alsop, which they are promoting as a concert to celebrate the Baltimore community. And New Jersey has a new major center for the performing arts as New Brunswick unveiled a new home for the George Street Playhouse, Crossroads Theater Company, American Repertory Ballet, and Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University. According to New Jersey Stage, the private opening of the New Brunswick Performing Arts Center on September 4th featured a toast by Mayor Jim Cahill and performances by the center's partner organizations. The building features two theaters, one seating 463 and a smaller theater for dance and theater performances with 252 seats, as well as five rehearsal rooms. The season formally opened the following night as Crossroads Theater Company presented a play based on the life of singer and activist Paul Robeson, who was a Rutgers graduate. The $172 million project is a public-private partnership between the city, Middlesex County, Rutgers, DevCo, and a number of cultural organizations, and is part of a larger development that includes office space and apartments. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. Hildegard von Bingen was a pioneer in many ways. A 12th century mystic, and later saint, she is probably one of the first Western women composers who have come down through the canon, and she also wrote works on science and medicine and advocated for some reforms within the church. Those central visionary themes are played out in a new musical in development called Hildegard, An Unfinished Revolution, written by Ethan Krupp with music by David Reddick. A student reading of the work will be presented Tuesday, September 10th at Princeton University's Lewis Center for the Arts, directed by Princeton alum Elizabeth Swanson. I chatted with Swanson and Reddick this week to talk about why they chose her story and this particular format in which to tell it.
So I was a music composition major, and taking the conservatory route, you do a lot of music history. And in most music history books, Hildegard's kind of the first chapter. There's some like Greek stuff before that, and, like they'll try to do some proto music, but like Hildegard is the first composer we have in Western music history with a biography. So from that perspective, musically, it's very fascinating, but also wrote the first musical. She wrote the first morality play called Ordo Virtutum, which was revolutionary for the time. So it seems too necessary to write a musical about the woman who wrote the first musical.
And then, Elizabeth, what drew you to wanting to be part of this?
Dave, Ethan, and I had collaborated on a couple other projects before that, and we were meeting in February 2018 to talk about one of them and its next stage. And at the very end of the meeting, I said, hey, what else are y'all working on? And they started telling me about Hildegard, who I'd never heard of. I'm a person of faith. I'm a practicing Christian Presbyterian. And when they started talking about Hildegard, it sort of opened up an avenue to explore a biography musical, which I've always been fascinated by in kind of a Jean Valjean vein, as well as Hamilton. I've always loved telling women's stories. I like telling stories about people of faith and taking those stories at face value. And I thought it was just the perfect vehicle for a musical because she's a musician. And it just kind of clicked immediately.
So what elements are you able to bring in and focus on in the musical itself?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think part of what I've always had trouble with when dealing with a really academic figure like Hildegard is that we want to be, generally it's treated with a sort of academic take, where it's very strictly like of her music, trying to kind of get into the medieval mindset, which is not to speak ill of any of the other works. I mean, they've done great, great things. But I think where we've gone differently is taking her music, taking elements of her ideas and repackaging it into more of a pop-friendly format. For example, there's a track, O Viridissima Virga, which is one of her most famous compositions, that, you know, you add just a little bit of rhythm, you add some modern harmonies to it, and it doesn't sound like it wouldn't belong on top 40 radio.
How did you bring those styles in, and what were some of the things that really made her work both representative of her time, but maybe with a bit of an edge?
Yeah, so she definitely had an edge. I would say the two biggest things that always stood out to me about her style, first and foremost, is the virtuosity of her singing and of her compositions, where you have these massive leaps and massive ranges that if you handed them to an average performer, wouldn't be able to handle. So she was giving more attention to the idea of the virtuosic performer, first and foremost. Secondly, what's really neat is her attention to detail, connecting lyrics and music. I think you could probably argue that some people were doing that before her, but again, we don't really have much of a biography to suggest that. And the idea that music should reflect text. If you're talking about something that is, you know, soaring into the heavens, you should have a soaring melody that comes up. If it's a more tender moment, then it should get softer. Things we sort of take for granted now in songwriting, a lot of that comes from Hildegard, and then would be later copied in like madrigalism that just got kind of cheesy. But yeah, just very much an attention to detail with how do you take text and turn it into music.
Mm-hmm. And in a storytelling perspective, she sort of has a modern pop because she is demanding space in a world in which there's literally no space for her. She defies every norm. Historians who talk about her will go down the list of the first that she had to her name because she doesn't quite belong in the history as we understand it. And so when you look at a woman who needs to take up space, not just for her own sake, but because she sees herself as a vehicle for ideas that she needs to propagate to get out there, she invents modes of being in this church. She pulls away and actually secedes from the abbey in which she lived for the first 45 years of her life, mm-hmm. and starts the Abbey of Rupertsburg through very politically savvy means as a series of negotiations and rubbing up to people with power and negotiating over the course of years to be able to get this so that she can truly do things her way as an abbess. And then from her abbey, she gives these lectures, these sermons, these preaching tours that call out all sorts of people in their positions of power. And the natural response, Barbara Newman writes about this, a historian, an American historian who handles Hildegard. She speaks about how Hildegard would go against people, you know, punch way above her weight class. And their response was never, hey, what did Paul have to say about women preaching? Shouldn't you be shutting up now? Because her not screeds, but her discerning arguments were so damning that they had to deal with the arguments themselves. And then she was very conservative in certain ways and staying very much with church theology and always towing the line so that nobody could ever shut her down completely.
And just to build off of that, too, I think, again, what's so powerful about Hildegard on paper is all of her accomplishments, is all of the academic ideas and stuff. But I think what's more compelling, honestly, is just her story, her human story. And I think anybody who is an accomplished academic and also has the human story deserves telling.
Mm-hmm.
The work deals with this in three different segments. Give us a little bit of an outline of how you progress through her story throughout the work.
Sure, yeah. So we very deliberately chose to start when she is able to get out of her anchoress cell. So the backstory behind it is that when she was very young, she started having visions from God. She was tithed away to the church as the 10th child in her family. There's also some evidence to suggest that her family was kind of freaked out that she was getting these visions. So from a very young age, she was trapped in this cell at this abbey with her friend, mother figure, who wasn't much older than her, Jette von Schwanheim. And she learns everything from this woman. She learns how to write, how to read, how to play music. We sort of just, I don't say gloss over it, but we try to start from the moment where Hildegard gets to make her first real choice in her life, which is when Jette dies, she steps out of the cell and she begins her life at like age 40. First and foremost, like that's a weird moment to start your life. You're starting at, in middle age and then trying to figure out what to do with the rest of your life. The rest of her story progresses where she writes down her visions. She gets approval from the Pope that they're actually from God. She starts her own abbey. She falls in love with another woman. There's a lot to suggest that, again, she had a homosexual relationship with this woman named Richardis that then breaks her heart, all the while she's writing the first opera, the first musical, which is where we end Act 1. And in that place, then we start Act 2, 15 years later, where she has become this truly powerful political force. And then through other issues that keep coming up, she has to reconcile being this public, political, musical, academic figure with the sort of human demands that keep coming up in her life. And we close at her death, after she runs afoul of the church, due to some, political issues about burying somebody who used to be a heretic in their cemetery, and try to tell it from this lens of the Trinity, the Holy Trinity, Creator, Holy Ghost, Christ, narrating her life and sort of figuring out how they can help to guide Hildegard to where she needs to go.
Now, the performance at Princeton will be a student, a reading of it, but on stage, what are some of the things that come into play as part of the production?
Some elements. We've never actually had a full staging. We've had a series of workshops in Chicago, all three of our hometowns. And in those readings, there's been a lot of work. And those workshops, there's been a lot of dramaturgical work around how, especially Act 2 is structured. Act 1 we find a lot simpler because it's driving towards Ordo Virtutum and one of her ultimate creations. So there's been a lot of thought about the place Hildegard has in relation with her friends and colleagues, Volmar, her best friend, secretary and editor in her day. He was a monk. Richardus, the love of her life, which is somewhat historically supported as much as anything homosexual is. So it's being in relationship with those people and also looking to make more prominent the nuns who followed her to Rupertsburg, the abbey that she established, or rather reestablished. We've been working a lot to look at the moments where her life intersects with the text that she produced, the conflicts in her age, and her own idea of what's important. The question we ask at the beginning of the musical is, how do you live when you know you're going to die? If you have so many years of your life, and they're cut in half because she was training under Jette and learning and also being bricked in as an anchoress. If your life starts in the middle and it is an actual zero-sum game, how you spend every moment of what's given to you, what is the best way forward? And so we're actively asking that question in a series of workshops. Eventually, we hope in the full staging to explore all sorts of 12th century iconography. We hope to explore her work in her actual illustrations. A student in the presentation actually just gave a very succinct argument for why the stage should be in the round. because it reflects Hildegard's idea of the cosmos as a feminine, round, circular, not necessarily eating itself, but sort of moving outward body in which we all live.
Building off of that, I think what I'm most excited about with this performance coming up is it is very much a representation of what we have been doing with the students this past week. You know, that question, what do you, or how do you live when you know you're going to die, came directly out of us simply workshopping the opening number and finding these new discoveries. So, again, we're not doing the entire show. We're not doing the entire show on Tuesday because that would just not be a good use of our time, and I don't think the students' time. What's been really, really great is hearing their analyses of the work, making those discoveries, and that's what we really intend to showcase on Tuesday.
So to back up and give you an idea of the production history, once the show was pitched to me in early 2018, we applied for the Chicago Fringe Festival with the idea that, look, we'll do either a song cycle or act one or what have you if we get in. And sure enough, we did get in, lottery style. And when we had a slot in the festival, Ethan and Dave started writing to it. And so they brought act one into the festival, and that got a good deal of workshopping before and since. But act two was actually written in light of a series of readings and workshops we held this summer, including our Princeton University residency at the Lewis Center for the Arts that we've been in for the last 6 days. So all that to say, Act Two is very fresh and is probably only arguably on its third draft. So it's been very interesting to tear everything apart and look at it act by act, scene by scene, and follow Hildegard's arc, the arc of the Trinity, the arc of Volmar, Richardus, the different elements of her life, as well as the church as represented by an abbot, Abbot Kuno, as well as the Archbishop of Mainz, and see what the church looks like as an adversary and also the institution that she's working within.
You know, it just rings with so many elements that I would think are relevant today, both in terms of a powerful woman at a time when that was very rare, the fact that her accomplishments were probably she was among few women from that time whose accomplishments really carried through to today, and also church reform, just lots of different things. What was it like seeing that being interpreted through student eyes from, you know, a generation in which these themes are so front of the mind?
You know, we found that these students, first of all, they're incredibly intelligent and articulate and bold in their ability to ask fundamental questions. As well, I think they don't have any inhibitions that we might have had from our micro generation before theirs of the kind of musical theater we consumed. You know, Hadestown just came out on Broadway, swept the Tonys. Hamilton has come out since we were consuming musical theater. And so that's these students' bread and butter in a way that they're able to immediately jump on our, you know, presumptions and our starting points, and get on board in a way that the buy-in was immediate, and then we could get into the ideas, even though the ideas to somebody, you know, maybe even 10 years older than us would sound absolutely ludicrous for a moment.
Now, getting back musically just for a minute, are there places where the music is very similar to the original form, or has it really been transformed into this more modern sense all through?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. We definitely leave space for actual chant. But most of it is taking Hildegard's themes and incorporating that into the pop paradigm. What's really interesting about it, though, is that Hildegard's music is all monophonic, right? Just one single line of music, no harmony added, anything like that. So adding harmonies to some of these monophonic lines that have a lot of weird little twists and turns and different like accidentals that would suggest it's in a mode, but then all of a sudden it's a different turn. It's really fun when having to use pop and jazz harmonies to accompany that. There's one melody in particular, O Dulce Divinitas, that, you know, I'm just going to sing on the radio, who cares? It sound like a, O Dulce Divinitas, has this little turn at the end that really is beautiful when you throw in these jazzy seventh chords and diminished chords. And I think part of the musical realization of this is that Hildegard probably heard these kinds of sounds in her head. She heard something bigger than just the monophonic. It's not necessarily, you know, my musical language, but she heard something more behind that and just didn't have the musical resources at that time truly generated. We have to remember that, like, right after Hildegard, we start to see actual polyphony with multiple voices, having these different lines that we associate with the Notre Dame School, with like a Leonin, building up into this Western musical language that we have today.
And what do you think it is that has given not just her work, but her name, the staying power? Granted, she's been seeing more of renewal in the last century or so, but the fact that people can look back and say, here was a woman who, as you said, is the first really named person we can point to in the Western canon of music, of Western classical music.
Part of it is that Hildegard is the most notorious female composer we have from that period, just because there weren't that many people writing music in the first place. But also, throughout history, female composers have just been erased. We look at somebody like Clara Schumann, who was a brilliant piano virtuoso, but also a brilliant composer. We've lost so much of her music because her father burned it. You know, it didn't want to have that history, right? Hildegard is in sort of an interesting place because she is in this Catholic tradition, and the music was so good. It was so good that it was just undeniable to erase from the Catholic canon.
As well, in 2012, the Catholic Church made her a Doctor of the Church, and I think that was a huge move to get her name out there, along with a Grammy-winning album that was put forth of Hildegard's music. So these kinds of landmarks in the last 10, 20, 30 years have certainly helped. I think as well, the millennial generation, we love spirituality. Mm-hmm. That really has proliferated beyond the walls of any church or specific faith or institution. And Hildegard is somebody that I think people can look at either from a place of a faith within an institution, especially Christian faith, and recognize her motives and her what drove her and the miracles she performed by way of her vision. And I think somebody outside a church and institution can recognize some things that have become more prominent recently, an appreciation for female divinity, an appreciation for a holistic life, focusing on plants and biology and keeping the humors balanced in your diet to ensure that you're living a life that keeps you sound and at peace. So there's a great deal to say about that, as well as a recent appetite for people who are able to write an extraordinary amount and do an extraordinary amount. We love a good story about, the hero's journey. And the hero lately has been somebody who puts out a great deal of text and thinks big thoughts in many different directions. Mm-hmm. And there's something we really admire about that. Probably that's set by our appetite for social media, in which everyone, is more plugged in and more wired up. And we're built to admire people who can work in those modes. So it certainly all is to the good as far as what kind of appetite people would have for Hildegard.
Well, as you mentioned, you've had a few workshop presentations of this. What's coming up in the schedule and where do you see this going?
We have, of course, our presentation at the Lewis Center for the Arts at Princeton this coming Tuesday. After that, we have a grant from the City of Chicago that we were very fortunate to receive that's allowing us to do a live album recording of a full concert-style reading of Hildegard, Act 1 and Act 2, and that's going to be in a music venue rather than a theater venue, as an acknowledgement that her music is what, and our music is what we really want to showcase about this show and its strongest point right now. After that, we will take that live album recording and we'll do what artists do, pitch it to producers, pitch it for more grants, hope to keep workshopping over the course of years. There's an old adage that musicals are not written but rewritten, and we're in it for the long game. We recognize that this is going to take many iterations and many workshops to continue refining it and finding the best way to tell this story and the cleanest and clearest and most inspiring way to tell this story. And so our aim is full productions of the highest caliber, which will require years of work.
Elizabeth said it very well. I mean, the future of this show, I believe in it wholeheartedly. And especially after this week, I just can't be more grateful to Jane and Stacy for giving us this opportunity. This has been probably the most efficient writing process we've had, just having this time to get away and use every single waking second to think big. This young woman who just gave a presentation on possible set designs for Hildegard could be in Madison Square Garden, right? There's all these possibilities. And I think what's really neat at this stage in the process is that there is no dream too big. There is no like sight unseen. I think this has real potential to hype myself. I really think it does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just to say more about this workshop, Jane Cox and Stacey Wolf is who he's talking about. Jane Cox is the head of the Lewis Center and Stacey Wolf, the head of the musical theater program. And they have welcomed us with open arms with a very new program, actually, a very recent, as of last year, inaugurated program to bring back recent alumni of Princeton University who are in the arts, who are working on projects like this, and to workshop them with the students. And to have students of a liberal arts background, as well as the time to sit in a room that has a beautiful working piano in it, which is sometimes hard to come by in a Chicago storefront theater, as well as the capacity to sit there as collaborators and duke it out, starting with our breakfast coffee, continuing through lunch during our lunch break, and have two sessions with the students, and then end the night over a bottle of wine, still trying to carve out the right path through whatever song we're trying to solve, has been the biggest gift to this musical at this stage in its process.
The biggest thing I just want for anybody who's considering coming to see the show, first of all, come see it. I think you'll really enjoy the music. Moreover, enjoy seeing what these students have brought to it. They've been amazing this past week, and the level of vulnerability that they've allowed us to have is really just very compelling. I think part of sometimes the musical theater culture can get very Slytherin-y, if you will, where, and again, that's not to talk ill of anyone. It's just that it's a very driven culture where everything has to be absolutely perfect, because if it's not, five different things get thrown off. Musical theater is hard because you have to sync up the music, you have to sync up the lights, you have to sync up the choreography. All of these things need to be happening at the same heartbeat, which doesn't usually allow for a lot of freedom and variation. But doing it in this safe space, if you will, where mistakes can be made, where ideas can be thrown out, and we can write a song over lunch and try it out and then see what works and what doesn't. I just think you'll be very pleased to see what has happened on Tuesday, but also even more pleased when the live concert recording comes out, because we will have a full band for that as well. Our music supervisor, Heidi Jostin, will be doing a lot of the orchestration for that. Yeah, overall, just very excited to see where this goes after this workshop.
That was my conversation with Princeton alumna Elizabeth Swanson, who is directing the musical in development Hildegard and Unfinished Revolution, and composer David Reddick. Princeton University's programs in theater and music theater will present a student reading of the work Tuesday, September 10th at 8 p.m. at the Lewis Center for the Arts. More information is available at arts.princeton.edu. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the classical performing arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only because of the support you give this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of A Tempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for A Tempo on our program page. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.